Thank you so much, Ted. That was really kind of you. And thank you all for welcoming me and having me here to talk to you this morning. I'm excited. I'm going to leave some time for questions at the end, and I really look forward to hearing your thoughts and having a good discussion this morning. So to get started, when I give a talk, I like to kind of situate myself in relationship to what it is that I'm talking about, which today we're talking about disability and we're talking about the church. So I grew up in Pittsburgh, and I grew up going to an English-speaking church in the mornings and the Ukrainian Baptist Church in Dormont, where my dad was a pastor, in the afternoons. It was a long day, you know. The English-speaking church, roughly, hour and a half for the service. Ukrainian-speaking church is 3 hours with three sermons. So I grew up learning to love a God who was incredibly inclusive, a God who calls for us to work for justice, and it, particularly as a pastor's kid in an immigrant church, I learned a lot about the value that immigrants bring to our country. And that's kind of what my relationship to religion was growing up. But I also knew and learned very quickly that not everybody believed in that kind of inclusive God. There were people who used religion to reject me, and other people like me who didn't fit their ideal of what a worthy human being looks like. And there were people who seemed to believe in this God who would reject me outright for the sexuality that at the time I kept buried inside myself, who believed in a God who would supposedly just heal me if I believed hard enough, if I prayed hard enough. And so for me, religion comes with a fair amount of hurt as well. And now today, these rejections related to religion propel me to fight for religious, spiritual, and other spaces that are inclusive and welcoming to everyone. But at the time, as a disabled queer person, I felt this stifling pressure of knowing that I would just never be good enough. Never be good enough for religious people, never be good enough for God. And so when I moved out of my family's home after high school, I pretty much stopped going to church. And I came back, you know, one Christmas Eve, my mom's urging to attend one of my childhood churches, the English-speaking one. And wouldn't you know it, the pastor chose that service to be one where he opened with this inspirational tale of a little boy who God cured of his disability. And I kind of wanted to throw up a little bit. You know, I was real tired of disability being this inspirational tale that drew other people closer to God, because, you know, it's through my disabled body and mind that I know God. And, you know, people like me, we're valuable as we are. We're not simply tools to be healed so that other people are drawn to God. And I know that I'm not alone in these church experiences, that churches can be places of great trauma for people with disabilities and LGBTQ people. And it boggles my mind that the Bible, that is so full of beautiful metaphors about disability, gets turned into these cutesy little stories about people with disabilities. Or, you know, sometimes they're just disabled props, right? They're not really treated like human beings at all. They're only there to be healed so that other people might believe. But there's this great potential to tell the story of how through being disabled, we come to know God. You know, these days, I go to Hot Metal Bridge Faith Community, which is one of those places where I have felt welcome in the fullness of my humanity. And I'm really hoping to find Westminster Presbyterian similarly welcoming this morning. For work, I work at the Pittsburgh Center for Autistic Advocacy, which is an organization entirely run by people on the spectrum, which means all of our staff and at least 50% of our board, though these days more like 80%, are folks on the autism spectrum. I've co-founded this organization with a friend of mine for the purpose of lifting up the voices of autistic people, because often these voices are left out of conversations about disability policy, whether that's talking about how we make a church more inclusive or how the state of Pennsylvania should take care of disabled people. But I do want to turn now to the subject of my talk today. That kind of situates me, I think, in relationship both to this space and to disability as well. And today, I want to specifically think about the ways in which the history of fighting for the rights of people with disabilities, particularly those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, are closely intertwined with biblical metaphors. And I want us to consider how these interconnections should lead us to treat people within the church. So I'll begin with a little history and background. Now, throughout human history, people with disabilities have been recognized as different, whether that means denigrated as less than human and left at the bottom of a mountain to die, or elevated as prophets and truth tellers. In this talk, I'm going to focus in particular on the ways in which we have cared for people with developmental and intellectual disabilities, or IDD, in the United States, often with specific references to Pennsylvanian history. We've cared for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in a variety of ways throughout our history in this country, most of them ineffective, and some of them downright cruel. The first real systemized way that our government has provided care was through a vast system of institutions across this country. Institutionalization of children with disabilities, which was an especially common practice prior to the 1970s, but is still in use today, including in our state. And I believe that our tendency to view children with disabilities as the kind of people who can only be cared for in special facilities is because we understand disability primarily as a medical problem, when in fact it can be so much more than that. Now, disabled children are, of course, still children, but disability was not, and still generally is not, considered a part of normal childhood development. The lives of children are shaped by the expectations of their parents and others, including the church, and recognition or diagnosis of disability in turn shapes those expectations. Thus, it was not at the time even thought that disabled children could be educated alongside their peers, but instead they were shuffled into what were called state schools, medical institutions where very little academic education actually occurred. Now, these institutions, which began to be founded in the early 1800s in Pennsylvania, were arguably better than the poor houses that came before. Yet, the conditions at institutions continued to be poor. Staff-to-resident ratios were inadequate, resulting in a lack of necessary care. Little schooling occurred, and to put it somewhat politely, the institutions were, in fact, filthy. But these conditions remained shrouded in secrecy from their inception, only contributed to the mistreatment of institutional residents. Parents were told by doctors that institutionalization was the best choice for their children, with little to no discussion of alternatives. And it was common for physicians and other professionals to tell families of children with disabilities, and I quote, "It is best that you put him away and forget about him." And after dropping their children off, parents would generally not be allowed to see where their children were living. By the mid-1900s, Pennsylvania alone had approximately 40 institutions for people with intellectual and developmental disability. And in particular today, I want to focus on a case study of one of them. In 1903, construction of the Eastern State Institution for the Feeble-Minded and Epileptic, that is hard to say at this time of the morning, later known as Pennhurst State School, began in Pennsylvania. The so-called school was overcrowded nearly from the beginning, and conditions only worsened as time continued. While the campus was expanded throughout the 1920s and 30s, it was quickly filled to capacity once again. In 1949, the Pennsylvania chapter of the Association for Retarded Children, which is now just called the ARC because we don't do the R word anymore, was founded. The ARC's primary focus was on research. The Government Affairs Office in D.C. did not, in fact, open until the 1960s. In Pennsylvania, an act mandating that individuals with intellectual disability be provided education in public schools was passed in 1956, and in 1966, the Pennsylvania Mental Health / Mental Retardation Act was passed, providing some funding for community-based supports, which would ultimately be the foundation of ARC's continued advocacy in this state. In 1968, NBC10 ran a scathing expose of the Pennhurst State School, revealing that the institution was rife with abuse and neglect. For many in the public, the expose, narrated by Bill Baldini, was their first exposure to the horrific conditions at Pennhurst. Baldini was responsible for exposing extensive malpractice on the part of both medical practitioners and the state, and the response from parent advocates, many of them organizing under the heading of the ARC, would revolutionize the ways in which both medical care and education was provided to disabled people. The title of this expose, Suffer the Little Children, echoed the words of Jesus in Matthew 19:14. Suffer the little children and forbid them not to come unto me, for such is the kingdom of heaven. And yet, the vast majority of institutional residents were adults, with the average age being 40 years old. While Suffer the Little Children inspired parent advocates to action, the expose also encouraged parents to view Pennhurst residents as helplessly childlike, in need of aid, and as medical problems. The use of the word child to describe adults with IDD reminded parent advocates of familial relationships, thus spurring them to donate time, resources, and advocacy skills. But on the other hand, this use of child also remained an example of the continued infantilization of disabled adults, which I argue continues to restrict to this day the development of self-advocacy skills in adults with IDD. The use of child, then, both causes harm and also, on the flip side, underwrites calls to action for change. Now, in this talk, I'm going to continue to explore the implications of referring to adults with IDD as children, which is still a very common practice, through the lens of a brief study of this expose and then moving into a look at some of my favorite scripture passages about disability. Because the frequent religious overtones of the common cultural practice of considering even adults with disabilities as childlike prompts this question of how should the church treat people with IDD? So I want to explore the ways in which this universal notion of being a child of God is leveraged in a particular way to disenfranchise adults with intellectual and developmental disability. Throughout scripture, among other metaphors that help to conceptualize an unknowable God, God is understood in part as a parental figure, a father, or less often, a mother, and his followers are understood as his children. I think we speak of ourselves as children of God so frequently that we sometimes forget to analyze what that actually means. We are not and will never be God's equals, but he nurtures us as we grow and learn. Now, believers with intellectual and developmental disabilities are also children of God, equal in his eyes to his children without such disabilities, no better and no worse. And yet our societal discourse does not reflect such equality. This societal discourse extends within the walls of the church. So I argue that intellectually or developmentally disabled individuals are rendered visible as eternal children, children not only of God, but of human society at large, which is a key difference from the ways in which the biblical metaphor is used to refer to adults without disabilities. This ongoing and pervasive infantilization of disabled adults reifies a normative ethics that disregards the breadth of capacity that these individuals may have. And this ought to cause us to question, when we treat disabled adults like children, and when we see the existence of disabled children solely through a medical lens, what does that imply about the agency of actual children and of disabled adults? And if disabled adults are constructed as eternally childlike, what does a disabled futurity even look like? If our mass media portrays people with IDD in this way, how can we expect our medical professionals, or even our preachers, to do better? To return to our case study, throughout the Suffer the Little Children expose, biblical metaphors abound, used in ways that minimize the contributions of disabled people while maximizing viewers' perceptions of their childlike need for care. Now, in purely colloquial usage, disability and childhood are not equivalent. And yet, the frequent use of phrases like mental age to describe intellectually disabled people, or of retarded to describe the supposedly immature behavior by someone without a disability, is consistent with a construction of certain kinds of disability as childlike in our society. Furthermore, many Pennhurst parents and family members saw their disabled relative only for sporadic visits in supervised settings, discouraged from too greatly disrupting the institution's routine daily life. Perhaps as a result of this infrequent contact, parents continued to think of their disabled relative as the child they first dropped off, especially given that the institution did not truly have the capacity to educate in developmentally appropriate age. There's another phrase we use to conflate disability and childhood. An extended interview with Vice President Hubert Humphrey in the expose is one example of the ways in which biblical metaphors are used to reinforce these perceptions of people with IDD as childlike. Humphrey, in arguing for better quality care for people with IDD, says, quote, "This rich country, this great country, and I must say it is very great and very rich, can afford to take care of the least of these." Now, there's a lot we could unpack in that statement relative to our current political climate. I'm not going to do it. What I do want to think about is how the characterization of the least of these is applied to adults with disabilities. This characterization hints at an underlying reason for the construction of people with IDD as childlike. Now, the reference here is to the end of Matthew 25, verses 34 through 40. Which I'm going to quote here from the NIV. "Then the king will say to those on his right, 'Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me. Truly, I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me.'" Now, the vice president's reference to this passage seems to understand the least of these as referring to those reliant on others for their care, which certainly makes sense in the institutional context. Yet in the passage where Jesus speaks of the least of these, he uses language that reflects equality, brothers and sisters of mine, which I understand to imply that literally all of us rely on others for our care, as none of us is truly independent of the work and support for others. So I have to question, what is it about the ways in which people with intellectual and developmental disabilities require care that causes us to label that as a special kind of care, a different kind of care than the care that people without IDD require? Because in so many ways, all of us rely on other people to get through our daily life, whether that's a spouse or a partner who keeps us going, a close network of friends, people we call for advice before we make an important decision. And yet when people with intellectual and developmental disabilities do those same things, rely on partners, friends, and their community for care, we view that as something set apart and special, rather than an extension of what it means to be a human being. So I want to continue to think about this phrase, the least of these. In many ways, the vice president's use of this phrase reifies a comparison between disability and childhood as underscored by capitalist norms of which kinds of labor are valuable. You know, the more general lack of these marketable skills among the population at the Pennhurst Institution would have created a perception that, as individuals without the capacity to contribute to a capitalist society, indeed, as individuals who are a drain on society's financial resources, these residents are therefore childlike, and society is their parent. And yet there are so many ways that we can think about people with intellectual and developmental disabilities contributing to our society or to our church community. And I think we have to remember to include those things in our discourse as a church in ways that are not condescending, which I'm going to talk about in more detail later. Another scriptural reference occurs in a later interview in the expose. Joe, a 20-year-old and therefore adult Pennhurst resident, says that he would most like God to come visit him, since he never gets any visitors. The expose then immediately cuts to the scripture verse, "Suffer the little children to come to me, forbid them not, for such is the kingdom of God." And here we can see the scripture verse as the inspiration for the title of the expose. And yet, this occurs immediately after an adult, a grown-up, talks about wanting God to come and visit him, immediately delegitimizing his status as someone who, as an adult, is able to make decisions about who he'd like to come visit. This also prompts another comparison, that like Christian followers who rely on God, these so-called little children also need salvation, though of a more practical rather than spiritual sort. Thus, perhaps one reason for the construction of institutionalized adults as childlike within this expose is because capitalist modes of production confer adult status only on those who hold the kinds of employment considered valuable. All others requiring non-normative aid are childlike, positioned as requiring government handouts without their potentiality as consumers and producers fully realized. Here we might also think about the ways in which we talk about people who work at places like McDonald's. Institutional adults are also constructed through relative gradations of childlikeness, in which some are viewed as more capacitated or debilitated than others, to borrow terms from Jasper Poor. Now at this point we might say, who cares? This is a case study from decades ago, and anywho, what's so bad about using metaphors like childhood to describe disability? Though the Pennhurst Institution, the subject of this expose, has long been closed, people with developmental and intellectual disabilities continue to be infantilized. And there are also substantial risks in associating developmental and intellectual disability inherently with childhood, particularly the ways in which disabled individuals are made invisible as actors and decision makers, both as adults and as children. And here we might also consider the ways in which our society talks about youth activism in this country. You know, the young people have consistently propelled us forward, and it's weird to talk about young people as something that I am not, but also am, right? I mean, I teach a bit, and I ask my students, how many of you are millennials, expecting 50% of them or so to raise their hand? No, they're all Gen Z, and they think I'm old. I think that when we think about the ways in which people with IDD are infantilized, and then about the ways that we treat actual young people who are passionate about ideas and about calling for change, we can see the ways in which those two groups could work in some solidarity. Because these risks impact not only people with IDD, but all who are potentially disenfranchised from being part of decision-making, all who occupy this childlike role, including actual young people. Under the Americans with Disabilities Act, disabled people are entitled to autonomy and freedom, and the common practice of using metaphors of childhood to describe them has historically undermined these civil rights. Now, even today in Pennsylvania, we continue to debate over the best ways to care for people with developmental and intellectual disabilities, while rarely including their voices in these policy discussions. Two recent key policy discussions in Pennsylvania seem to illustrate this paternalistic attitude toward those with IDD. The first, a bill that would have banned abortions in cases where a fetus is diagnosed with Down syndrome, was recently vetoed by Governor Wolf. Throughout hearings in both the PA State House and State Senate, parents and advocacy groups spoke, but I cannot find a single record of an actual person with Down syndrome getting the opportunity to weigh in on the bill. Given this apparent lack of input from people with Down syndrome, this policy process seemed to be one in which the people pushing the policy used disabled people to push their own agenda. and regardless of where you stand on abortion, this should seem objectionable to you. Disabled people are entitled to their own political opinions and should not be used as tools to push certain agendas. And yes, I'll admit, I was a bit nervous to mention abortion in a church, but nerves have never stopped me from ruffling a few feathers. And honestly, at the end of the day, it's not about abortion, right? It's about people getting the opportunity to weigh in on policies about their lives. A second policy discussion that similarly exemplifies the tendency to exclude the voices of people with disabilities on disability policy issues is still ongoing in Pennsylvania right now. Earlier this year, Governor Wolf signed an executive order to begin the closure of the Whitehaven and Polk State Centers for people with IDD as part of an ongoing process of transitioning people with disabilities to community-based care, such a process being required by the LC versus Olmstead Supreme Court decision. Understandably, families of Whitehaven and Polk residents, along with the unions that represent the workers providing care, were concerned about the impact that this would have on the center residents and on union jobs. They approached state representatives and state senators who wrote a bill that would put a moratorium on this closure of these state centers. But once again, throughout the policy hearings on these topics, the voices of people with disabilities were ignored, downplayed, or worse. At one such hearing, a disabled man who had lived in a similar institution before transitioning to community care described during his testimony the sexual assaults that he experienced at a state center. The worst part is that other attendees at that meeting spoke over him and heckled him for describing this experience. It's also worth pointing out that at these hearings, no one currently living at Polk or Whitehaven spoke, though my understanding is that some of the residents have written letters to state legislators. And when we think about people with developmental and intellectual disabilities as children, it becomes easy to exclude their voices and downplay their experiences. Despite the fact that 80% of people with developmental and intellectual disabilities will experience a sexual assault before the age of 18, other attendees at this meeting felt like they could just speak over this person who was describing an experience that is overwhelmingly common for people in this population. Because when people with developmental or intellectual disabilities do speak up in these policy conversations, I find that there are two reactions from people who disagree with their perspectives. One response is that clearly the person with IDD is too disabled to have a valid opinion. The opposite response is that clearly this person is too argumentative, articulate, or too well-spoken to be disabled at all. And the latter response is frequently one that I get, because people do not always notice or acknowledge the ways in which I'm disabled. After speaking out on the closure of Whitehaven and Polk, I have received a substantial amount of online bullying, including an email which asked me to describe in detail the ways in which autism impacted my activities of daily living. Activities of daily living being things like eating food and toileting. This is a rather personal and inappropriate question. And if the parent who sent the email had read the things that I had written, she referenced that I had written a great number of things on this, she would have known the answer to her question, because I've been one of those people who have used my narrative to drive policy change. But she didn't actually read them, which meant that the question was not in good faith. And it's not an uncommon experience. You can see people having the experience that that man at the hearing had, or having experiences like I have had, the online bullying, simply for expressing an opinion rooted in my own personal experience. So the question is, how then, as the church, are we to act? This naturalization of the connection between disability and childhood reifies the infantilization of disabled people in areas of life beyond medical context, including in the church. I've experienced myself and seen others treated similarly where abled church members will speak down to members with disabilities. I've watched as members with disabilities get involved in church volunteer opportunities, only to see abled people talk about how cute it is that the church lets them do that. So I want to look at one of my favorite passages about disability in the Bible, which is Mark 7, 32 through 37, to think about the responsibility of the church around disability. They brought to him, Jesus, a deaf man who had an impediment in his speech, and they begged him to lay his hand on him. He took him away in private, away from the crowd, and put his fingers into his ears, and he spat and touched his tongue. Then looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, "Be opened." And immediately his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. Then Jesus ordered them to tell no one. But the more he ordered them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. They were astounded beyond measure, saying, "He has done everything well. He even makes the deaf to hear and the mute to speak." There are a few things in this passage that I want to draw your attention to as we think about the beginnings of the responsibilities of the church. First, notice that initially they brought the deaf man to Jesus. We are not told who they are, and their relationship to the deaf man is not immediately clear. We can certainly assume they're well-meaning. Perhaps they're the deaf man's family, or perhaps they are simply community members who care. Regardless of their relation to him, at the beginning of the story, the deaf man is not positioned as autonomously coming to Jesus. He is brought by others to Jesus. So what does Jesus do? He takes him away from the people who had brought him to a private setting. He restores the man's autonomy and control by eliminating the controlling elements around him. He honors the man's dignity by providing him care in privacy. Presumably, this would have been the man's opportunity to communicate if, in fact, he did not desire healing. Then, yes, like most of the stories about disability in the Bible, Jesus does heal him. But the key here is that Jesus tells them not to tell anyone about it. I read this as that the healing was for this man alone, not one of those inspirational, "I'll heal you so that others can benefit from faith" kinds of things. And then, you know, what would you know? But those around the man disobeyed Jesus and went around disrespecting the man's privacy rights again. Typical. I want to turn now to a second story about disability in the Bible, one that I think we don't often think about because it's not the typical faith healing story. Did you know that the prophet Moses was disabled? It's certainly not a lesson I grew up learning in Sunday school, though perhaps here it's different and you did know that. It was certainly not in my Bible lessons growing up, but it's written right there in Exodus 4. In this passage, God has called Moses to be his prophet, but Moses is doubting whether the people will believe that he has heard the voice of God. And when I've heard this passage preached on or taught in Sunday school, it's a passage about doubt and how God works through our doubt and helps us overcome that. But on a closer reading, I don't believe that's what it's about at all. God works through several of Moses' excuses, and Moses finally lands on the following final statement in verse 10. "Pardon your servant, Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue." Now, this only hints at disability, right? One can certainly be not eloquent, but also not disabled. But God's response to Moses lends further credence to the idea that Moses' response is about a speech impediment, or maybe a stutter, about something more than just a lack of eloquence. God responds, "Who gave human beings their mouths? Who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, I will help you speak and will teach you what to say." Here, God explicitly talks about disability and responds in a way to alleviate Moses' anxiety about his slow speech and tongue. But what's also interesting in this passage is that it implies that God intentionally makes disabled people, which of course reflects the general idea that God makes all of us. But it also speaks back to the idea that disability is somehow something unnatural, when in fact it is a natural part of human experience that someday probably everyone will experience if we're lucky to all get old enough. Moses is still concerned, though. He replies, "Pardon your servant, Lord. Please send someone else." So what does God do? After expressing some anger and frustration, and there's a weird bit about foreskin in here that I'm just going to skip, God provides a reasonable accommodation for disability to Moses. Look at this. He says, "What about your brother, Aaron, the Levite? I know he can speak well. He is already on his way to meet you, and he will be glad to see you. You shall speak to him and put words in his mouth. I will help both of you speak and will teach you what to do. He will speak to the people for you, and it will be as if he were your mouth and as if you were God to him. But take this staff in your hand so you can perform the signs with it." So the disabled man is the one who has the direct line to God. But God is willing to provide him a reasonable accommodation in the form of someone else to stand up front and talk. So what's the lesson for the church here about disability? First of all, don't make assumptions. An individual's understanding of their own disability and relationship to God is private. Maybe they are desperate for healing, and maybe they aren't. But either way, it's none of your business. The amount of well-meaning advice I've received from other church members is overwhelming. I'm tired of explaining why I don't want to buy pyramid scheme essential oils. Or how, yes, I have tried yoga, in fact, and guess what? Still disabled. Disabled people live in their own bodies and typically have had extensive discussions with their care team about what treatments are appropriate. And if we want your advice, we're capable of asking for it. Second, don't be a gossip. People's disabilities should not be the subject of speculation or discussion. If someone discloses something to you, keep it private, unless they explicitly give you permission to share. And certainly, don't use prayer requests as an opportunity to talk about other people's disabilities or health concerns, unless, of course, again, they've asked you to. I've been stopped in the street by strangers who want to lay hands on me and pray for my healing. And they somehow don't seem to buy my statement that God made me this way, despite the scriptural evidence of him knitting me together in my mother's womb. We need to disrupt the culture of Christianity that allows such a practice of stopping strangers on the street to seem acceptable. And that starts with the small things of not being a gossip in the halls of church. Third, while these passages have been about deafness and not about intellectual or developmental disability, what I would read into these passages is our responsibility to presume competence. Man, my tongue is going all over the place today. Talk about being slow of speech. It is our responsibility to presume competence and not be condescending. We ought to welcome people with IDD into all aspects of church life and ensure that we are providing the supports and accommodations necessary for them to be active participants in our communities. And yes, this could involve imagining a community with an intellectually disabled pastor who ministers not only to people like her, but also to abled people. Because it's time that we acknowledge that we can learn all kinds of lessons from people with developmental and intellectual disabilities, and that those contributions are just as valuable as anything that gets handed out through the pulpit by a pastor on Sunday mornings. If the prophet Moses was disabled and God provided him reasonable accommodations, then we can certainly do the same for people with disabilities in our congregations. We ought to treat them as our equals, remembering that we are all God's children, that we all contribute valuably to our spiritual communities, and that all of us deserve to be treated with respect and love. And furthermore, we ought to highlight biblical heroes who are disabled, not just the typical stories of the disabled beggars and the sick who are healed. Now, today, we're surrounded by people with disabilities all around us. The era of institutionalization does seem to hopefully be coming to an end. And yet, in the state of Pennsylvania and elsewhere around this country, the debate over funding for supports and services for people with disabilities continues, with close to 16,000 people waiting for services in our state alone. The institutions of today, like Whitehaven and Polk, which are currently being debated in our state assembly, are clean, beautiful, and staffed by what are competent, incredibly qualified people. But all our research shows that, nevertheless, outcomes are still better when people with disabilities are cared for in their communities, and churches are, for many people, a valuable part of such community. Now, churches typically have no legal obligation to be accessible, but I would argue that we have a biblical obligation to lead the way toward a world where people with disabilities are fully integrated into society. Churches should be a place of refuge from the ableism that permeates our culture, not a place where ableism is concentrated and then used to disenfranchise people from true participation. Churches should be places that people can come and know that they are loved not despite their disabilities, but loved for the fullness of their being, including disability. Including all of the valuable things, not just the hard things, all of the valuable things that disability brings to our lives. This journey has not been an easy one for me, and as we know, life is a journey that goes on. I'm not going to tell you that being disabled does not come with difficult things. It's certainly not easy to be an autistic person, to be a person with a genetic connective tissue disorder that causes substantial amounts of pain in this world. It is not easy to constantly have to advocate for the rights of people like me. In fact, it's exhausting. And at the end of the day, what I want most for myself, for other people like me, is the ability to find a spiritual community where they can feel at peace, where we can feel loved, and where for the moment we don't have to worry about constantly advocating for the fact that we do belong. So that's the talk. I would be happy to answer any questions, or if you have comments, participate in the discussion. But thank you for having me. Yeah.
I appreciate everything you've said. I've known people who are intellectually disabled, and I know that the law is very harsh, and society is not very helpful, and the churches are not very accepting. So here's the problem I see. An intellectually challenged girl can become pregnant, have a child, and I've seen that happen where the girl's rights are terminated in court.
Yes.
Because of the child's best interest standard. Mm-hmm. But although the mother loves the child, and maybe this is an older child who can know the mother, the child knows the mother and wants to stay with the mother would have trouble financially, with medical issues, with school issues, with housing issues. Mm-hmm. And even though the mother can provide the love and nurturing, the mother needs help to provide the other things. So where do you find that help? One thing would be a host home where the mother could live there, take care of the child, but have adults supervising and assisting mother with these other things. But there are not many host homes. Very hard to find.
Yes.
There are services that can assist somebody like the Office of Intellectual Disability, but they don't help the mother as a mother. They can help the mother as an individual. That doesn't solve the problem. There are services that can help the mother with parenting and other things. It's hard to get them involved in a case. So what happens is time runs out on the mother, and the mother's rights are terminated. And the child's in a foster home and does well. Everything you're saying here indicates that's very unfair.
It's heartbreaking.
Not ethical. And morally, there's something missing here. So there's changes may be proposed in legislation and funding, but we're still not there. Any hope?
Yes.
What is the hope?
The hope is that we get there someday. Right, I have to believe that we get there someday. And you're exactly right. So for those of you who aren't familiar with the way the services work, if you receive services for your disability that are funded by the state, which is how most folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities receive services in Pennsylvania, you can receive them in two places. You can receive them in a state institution, which is kind of what I was talking about here, or you can receive them in a community-based setting. But the people who the state pays to help you cannot help with your child. They can't even microwave a bottle, right? And that's a problem. At the Pittsburgh Center for Autistic Advocacy, we work with a number of parents who are concerned about losing their children because while they have, you know, supports and services for themselves, none of that can be, you know, used to help them parent. So there is the possibility for a significant amount of legislative change. And the biggest one would be actually fully funding the systems that provide supports in the home, because that's where we end up with the 16,000 people waiting, because the services that they are legally entitled to are not fully funded. And so if we could get the waiver services funded, that would go a long way. People then wouldn't be waiting for services for themselves. I think restoring the General Assistance Fund would be a huge thing. The Pennsylvania State Legislature just terminated that program, which provided a few hundred dollars a month that you could spend on anything. Most people were spending it on deodorant and tampons and, you know, things you can't buy with food stamps, right? So there's a potential for a larger kind of social safety net. There's also really cool things that we can do as community members. Some folks are engaging in what's called life sharing, which is, I think, kind of what you were referencing with the idea of a home that people can parent in where there's other folks supervising. Some people are taking it a step further and, like, in their own private home, they are doing what's called life sharing, where the person with a disability and then sometimes their child just is part of the family. And that's a new program that the state is beginning to provide funding for, assistance for. So most of it comes down to money and what we're willing to spend it on.
Do you know any churches that help with this?
With this stuff in particular? I mean, I will shout out my church as a really good example of a church that includes people with disabilities in all areas, including in, like, church leadership. But as far as specifically connecting people to supports and services, I'm not aware of any church that has that kind of program. It would be really useful. There's a big lack of care coordination in the state. So care coordination, those are the people who organize all of the services for you. And some people get funding from the state to have a care coordinator. Some people get funding and can't find a care coordinator, and other people don't get funding for a care coordinator at all. And that's another big need, is to have, for people with disabilities, to have assistance in coordinating their services. Long way to go still.
Take this question in the right light, and I'm not advocating that institutions should stay open, but statistically, how many folks in a number of different capacities, whether it's intellectual or otherwise, don't have these, there's not institutions to work with them now, end up in prison?
Yes, so ending up in prison or ending up homeless is a big thing, right? So statistically, if we look at Allegheny County Jail, for example, 80% of people in Allegheny Jail have a diagnosed disability. Now, not all of that is developmental or intellectual, but there is a good chunk that is. The ACJ is the largest provider of mental health services in Allegheny County. And that should be a statement that makes all of us really, really sad. It should not be that way. So yes, part of what happens when institutions are closed without adequate transition time and without adequate transition plans is that people end up with nowhere to go.
And are these community, I'm not familiar with it or very familiar with it, yeah. Community-based alternatives, does that include community-based housing as well, or a group, almost a communal type group?
Yeah, like group homes would be included under that. And some folks do get transferred from institutions into what are called intermediate care facilities, which are like larger group homes with more on-site staff.
And the outcomes there tend to be better?
The outcomes there tend to be better. But better, yes. better than prison. And so what's happening now, thankfully, with the closure, the most recent one that has closed was Hamburg, and everybody had a personalized transition plan to place them in another setting. And all of the workers were given the opportunity to have another government union job, which was good too. So it's for Whitehaven and Polk, it's a 3-year transition, and it's supposed to have, the moratorium may pass. We'll see. I think there's a veto-proof majority, so that'll be what it'll be. But the plan for it is a 3-year transition and to get everybody to other placements.
But the scope of what we're talking about here, I don't view that as a solution.
I don't either, but people don't like it when you call group homes mini-institutions. No, outcomes are best when people are receiving services in their own homes.
And what is the family for them without getting back on the family that may have institutionalized, or quote, yeah, the word institutionalized someone? Where's the family for them?
Yeah, so it depends. I mean, some people do receive what are waiver services, home and community-based services, in their families' homes. Other people have their own apartments and receive services, so... there's a really cool complex in Heidelberg, and it's an apartment building. It's 50% folks on the autism spectrum and 50% folks who do not have an autism diagnosis. And a good chunk of people who are living in this apartment building with their own apartments receive waiver supports and services. So that's a cool model, too, because there's a sense of community there, but it's also integrated because you have folks who are not autistic who live in the building. But it is a place where people who don't necessarily have a family who wants them to be in the family home can find a sense of independence, but also safety and community. Yeah.
A few years ago, I had the opportunity to be involved with the Goodwill, so I can get a plug for the Goodwill, which many people think of as physically disabled, helping physically disabled, but they have moved into helping developmental. As I recall, a religious denominational base. It was Methodist. I think it's broadened now, but it was a church's response to need. Separately, I want to ask you a question. What is your opinion about the success of what's called mainstreaming in public schools? It's required in many states, but is it successful?
So the law requires that children be educated in the least restrictive setting possible. So the law does not say most inclusive setting possible or most integrated setting possible. It says least restrictive setting. So that can be interpreted in any number of ways. I think for a lot of kids with disabilities, mainstreaming can be really successful, especially, if, and this is a problem where people are supposed to have a one-on-one aid, but then there's not, nobody's available. There are a lot of people who have the funding from the state to have a, one-on-one aid in the classroom with them who can't find staff. And I think that that has contributed to a lot of failures of mainstreaming. But there are also communities who believe strongly in segregated education. We can look, for example, at the deaf community, who has these strong cultural ties to the idea of deaf education. You can look at Gallaudet University in D.C. as an example. We also have a school for deaf children here in Pittsburgh. And who am I to say to someone who believes their child should be educated in a deaf cultural setting that their child should be mainstreamed? In many ways, for deaf children in particular, mainstreaming has been incredibly harmful. It has caused them to lack language development both in ASL and in spoken English. So in that case, mainstreaming, not great. But I have to believe in the promise of mainstreaming and the idea that if people really had the supports and services that they needed, it would be successful for a lot more kids. Particularly kids with developmental and intellectual disabilities who don't, the deaf community, I think, is a separate example. I have to believe there's some promise there, though, of course, there's always going to be kids who do not do well in a classroom setting, and we have to do what's best for them and for the other children in that classroom.
Thank you.
came to you, let's say the child was really not disabled in any way and probably is able to go to college someday, and the child has an intellectually disabled mother, and the child asks you, why did God let my mother have me when she's intellectually disabled and I'm not? What would you say to the child?
It's an interesting hypothetical. I think I would say to the child that God, that it's hard to know why God does certain things, but that I would probably ask them to consider the things that they have gained and also the things that they have lost. I usually ask a lot of questions. But I'd honestly be surprised if somebody asked me that question. You know, the vast majority of folks who get to stay with a disabled parent are happy about it, glad about it. And so I would be surprised if somebody did ask me that question.
You'd be surprised if a child would put the question in that way.
Would put the question in that way, or, I don't know, children learn biases from adults, right? Children do not come out of the womb thinking that people with intellectual disabilities are inferior parents. They learn those lessons from culture and from other people around them.
So they see the mother's strengths rather than her weaknesses.
I mean, I think that young children especially consider parents in a way that is less influenced by outside cultural standards than adults do. Now, they can grow up to believe in a number of things, but I also have to imagine that developmentally and intellectually disabled parents are raising their children to understand the value of disability.
Yeah. Is there any hope for legislation that would address like the family aspect of the disability, like example being gay, or you know that yeah. Everything is directed at the person as opposed to the environment or the family that they're part of as a child?
Yeah. So there's a really cool bill called the Family Care Act that is currently moving its way through the Pennsylvania legislature that does a lot of things to provide support to families who are both raising a disabled child or who are disabled themselves and raising a child who may be abled. So I'm excited about that. It's being spearheaded by the same people who are working on all of the disability employment legislation. And they have a great track record of getting bipartisan support. And we've seen that with this piece of legislation as well. It's really. I'm sorry?
At a federal level, is
there
anything like that?
Yeah. Right. So the big thing with the federal government is that they provide funding for a lot of these things, or matching funding, really, is what it is. So Pennsylvania has exceeded their federal match for Medicaid, which means that you know any additional funding for these services has to come from Pennsylvania tax money rather than you know the federal, and that's a thing that can change. The federal government can change how much money it provides to the state for Medicaid services, so that you know could be a possibility. The Disability Integration Act is also a really cool piece of legislation that it's very broad. It basically takes the Americans with Disabilities Act and, you know, rather than the ADA is a great bill. It's the foundation of our civil rights, but it is enforced by lawsuits. So if you are not a person with means, which most disabled people are not, because you can only make so much money before they take things away from you, then sorry, you're out of luck. So the Disability Integration Act takes a lot of the provisions of the ADA, put some funding behind it and put some force behind it, and you know I think would be a really powerful way of supporting both families and also people with disabilities themselves. So yeah, I saw your hand back there.
So this certainly one of the things to think about, and I'm slightly embarrassed to ask a really narrow question, but
okay.
Earlier in your talk you talked about these institutions for epileptics and
yeah.
I'm just wondering, you know, in the context of thinking about medicalizing conditions that are not really medical, what was the history around the lumping of epileptics in there?
Yeah. So we used to institutionalize a whole lot of people, right, including people with mental illness as well. And mental health has been community-based for a long time. There are very few residential programs for folks with mental health concerns. And they were kind of the first to deinstitutionalize. After that, there were institutions for folks who were blind and deaf, and those were deinstitutionalized. The lumping in of epilepsy with IDD is an interesting one, and it happens because a lot of folks with IDD also have epilepsy, and vice versa. So the parts of the brain that cause epilepsy to be a thing also influence other kinds of development. And so in these institutions for folks with IDD, you would see people with epilepsy, you would see people with other physical health things as well. So like for instance, autism and Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is the connective tissue disorder that I have, are very closely linked. And that's because they are impacted by the same part of the brain. And so that's part of why some of these more physical conditions get lumped in with IDD during our periods of figuring out which boxes to put people in, basically. All right, any other questions? Did we? See, we were having such great fun. Thank you all for having me. This is really great.